Welcome to Think Business Futures. On the show, we take cutting-edge business research and couple it with real-world examples to explore what's actually happening in the business, finance, and marketing worlds. I'm Nicole Sutton, lecturer in accounting at the UTS Business School, and on this episode, we're looking at the changing nature of corporate social responsibility. And to unpick this, we're lucky enough to have Professor Peter Fleming, Professor in Management from the UTS Business School. So, Peter, let's start at the beginning. I'm interested to understand what exactly is corporate social responsibility. Now, just a word of warning to our listeners, The acronym for that is
CSR.
And so, I mean, that could be, you know, a packet of sugar.
Yep.
And when we're talking about CSR today, we're not talking about the sugar. No. We're talking about corporate social responsibility. So,
sure.
What is it and where did it come from?
So corporate social responsibility as a practice has been around for a long time, a concern at least. You know, with the birth of the modern corporation and modern business, there was always a concern about how that profit-maximizing behavior would influence society more generally. Mm-hmm. And so you got the rise of paternalism, you know, workers' rights, et cetera, organizations being a little bit more worried about what is occurring in the broader sphere of its influence. But it really took on the acronym of CSR, corporate social responsibility, really emerged as a fully fledged idea in the 1960s and 1970s. Mm-hmm. This is when corporations basically were suffering a sort of a legitimacy crisis.
Are you greedy? One of the principal things about the 60s that I remember is how much people hated the big corporation without a soul. We hated them because they were so dehumanizing.
So they had been pursuing their profit maximization strategies very happily, you know, in the chemical industry, petroleum, oil, steel industry, and a whole raft of other industries that then were beginning to be questioned regarding their impact on everyone else. So be it the consumer, be it the natural environment, be it society more generally in terms of workers' rights and so forth. And so they had to come up with a response, a narrative. And one of the responses was corporate social responsibility, in which firms began to say what they were doing above and beyond that profit-maximizing activity. Now, it's important to also note that the idea was contested. For example, Milton Friedman, on the hard right of neoclassical economics, said the idea was terrible.
How do you define socially responsible? What business is it of the corporation to decide what's socially responsible? That isn't their expertise. That isn't what their stockholders asked them to do. So I think they're going out of their range, and it certainly is not democratic.
But that view actually kind of fell to the wayside, and corporate social responsibility took off as a narrative, at least, mainly in the form of philanthropy. So with these huge profits, giving back to the community in various shapes and forms, and you see that even today with, you know, philanthropy in full swing in the United States. So that's really kind of, with that contradiction, really kind of promoted and gave birth to the idea of corporate responsibility. So what is the firm, what is your business doing above and beyond just making money, given the possibly detrimental effects that that operation might have on everyone else?
And so apart from giving money away, What are some of the other ways that companies do CSR? What sort of things do they do when they're showing that they are, you know, acting responsibly and they're going above and beyond just the profit motive?
Well, it takes many, many forms. So, for example, oil firms operating in Nigeria, Africa might be kind of setting up wells for clean water or maybe investing in schools. You have a branch of organisations interested in the environmental impact and the detrimental effects that their products may have on the environment, and trying to taper, if you like, those effects or develop new products. you might have interest in workers' rights, so that the firm basically wants to be seen as a best employer, mm-hmm. and that's part of its corporate social responsibility program in the sense that it's not exploiting workers to the hilt as it otherwise could. Supply chains, there is kind of regulatory oversight on supply chains to make sure that, you know, no one's been horribly harmed in the supply chain to bring your computer, your laptop or your iPhone to the market. So there's various ways in which the organisation can at least promote or publicise what it is doing above and beyond simply the bottom line.
Now, on this bottom line, this reminds me of a phrase that we hear in relation to corporate social responsibility, which is triple bottom line.
Sure.
Now, I'm an accountant. I have an idea what a bottom line is, but what's a triple bottom line?
So it all comes from sustainability. Yep. So if the idea is that an organisation to be responsible has to be sustainable, a triple bottom line is where you've got profits, mm-hmm. and then you've got the environment, and the stakeholders around the organisation have to also be treated in a sustainable manner. In other words, that it's just not a short-term burst of exploitation. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to extend the bottom line approach to say the only thing that matters is profits, is to say, well, you know, there are these other two bottom lines. And then the big sub-debate in the academic discourse, at least, was to say, okay, so is that good for business or not? Mm. And so there's a big argument to say that corporate social responsibility isn't just an expense, just doesn't dig into the profit motive, but it can actually be good for the profit motive because of reputation, because of the goodwill of consumers, and so forth.
So you said before that companies can engage in CSR as a way to indicate their kind of virtue. And so who would be their intended audiences of their CSR policies and credentials?
Well, there can be a number of audiences depending, I guess, on the industry and the organisation involved, but you would obviously have a strong signal given to the government, given that they're the boss of society and they make the rules, mm-hmm. And you want to keep them on board. So the government would be, regulators would be a major target audience.
So in that situation, you want to be showing that you're doing enough so that the government's not forced into a position to renege on your social license to operate and change regulations and have to crack down on you. So in one sense, you can say, look, we're already doing things. We're
yep.
And so then you're not waiting for governments to add more regulation
exactly.
to you.
Exactly. Yep. So there's a strong risk management element
yep.
to corporate
yep.
social responsibility. Another audience may be workers.
Yep.
And especially in this day and age in which, you know, some have suggested that the younger generation, the millennials in particular, are worried about who they work for, and that having symbolic blood on your hands is nothing that anyone wants to have, and that they're less tolerant, I guess, of working for unethical firms that are publicly deemed unethical or perceived to be unethical than older generations who saw it as just a job and, you know, got on with things when they then were giving to the SPCA when they got home.
Do you have a sense of when that shift started to happen in terms of when companies had to be a little bit more attuned to a changing generational preference?
It's happened over the last 10 years and there's no key catalyst, but I guess there's a number of issues that changed that brought this into the light. I guess the financial crisis really kind of pushed the global financial system into a legitimacy crisis. That really hasn't really recovered from.
The scope of this fall, breathtaking. First, Bear Stearns, now Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch.
Is your money safe? Is your job safe?
Economists say this is the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
In popular discourse, you know, if you want to have the most ruthless person, you know, evil, secular version of evil, it's usually a Wall Street banker, right? Whether it's deserved or not.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
And also, I think, you know, my theory is that a lot of the millennials today saw their parents slave at the office and they paid off their mortgage and et cetera. But, you know, divorces, high blood pressure, the social cost and the physiological cost in some cases of that work ethic, they look at the older generation and think, I don't want to be like that and I don't want to forgo my ethical views simply because I work for someone.
So apart from potential employees, apart from the government, who else has Who else is running their kind of their fingers down the CSR credentials of different companies?
Well, you would have consumers. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of debate about whether consumers really care or not. Officially, they do. That a consumer will opt for a more ethically sourced product than one that is at least publicly criticised for being unethical. And then you've got not only workers who you want to recruit, but your workforce per se is a very important part of this whole approach as well. And so you see corporate social responsibility becoming an interest of human resource managers in corporations. And so that's important as well because, you know, really your people are your organisation, and if they're annoyed and if they decide to withdraw their labour, you're in big trouble.
You're listening to Think Business Futures. To download this show, head to 2scr.com or your favourite podcasting app and look for Think Business Futures. On this episode, we're talking about corporate social responsibility with Peter Fleming. Now, Peter, I'm going to read you an excerpt from a company's statement about their corporate social responsibility. I think it's from Uber. Mm-hmm. And they have their, this is a statement from their policy, and it's entitled Global Citizenship. Mm-hmm. And in this kind of statement, the company's going to address policies on safer communities, diversity, inclusion, environmental sustainability, and accessibility. But I just want to read you this statement first off. Today's communities face an unprecedented set of challenges. And while technology by itself isn't the solution, when it's done right and combined with good partnerships, it has the potential to contribute to a better world for all. So what are your thoughts about a statement like that and Uber's position, for example, on corporate social responsibility?
Well, Uber and a number of similar corporations have obviously, you know, jumped on the bandwagon of corporate social responsibility and want to be seen by the public and the paying public, but also government regulators, which is obviously big on their radar, given the controversy around the gig economy. They want to be seen that they are doing more than exploiting their underpaid workers. And so it's not surprising that they would come out with a narrative regarding their social benefits and their social value in terms of the wider society. But this kind of goes to the heart, I think, of the problem with corporate social responsibility more generally. And the critics right from the start were kind of homing in on this, that, you know, is it just talk? Is there really a effort to change the business model so that it is more harmonious with the environment or with consumers or with the broader social expectations? Or is it just window dressing? Is it a kind of, I guess, want for want of a better word, a type of propaganda, so that business as usual goes on otherwise? And so there's a lot of debate about that. And, you know, I don't think it's that surprising that some of the more controversial businesses and industries do tend to have quite a colourful corporate social responsibility statement on their websites.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I do recall, it's funny you mentioned business ethics courses, and the classic business ethics example to bring up is Enron's kind of vision statement.
Yeah.
And the things that they talk about in terms of integrity and honesty and and so on. It's almost hilarious, the hyperbole that goes into how ethical they are and so on, and how much they care about their communities. And and we all know what happened to Enron in the end.
No, exactly. Yeah. It's almost as if the more controversial an industry or a business is, the more emphasis they put on their corporate social responsibility mandate.
Now, I want to turn to an issue that you raised in a recent opinion piece you wrote for the Sydney Morning Herald around another issue to do with corporate social responsibility. Was this growing trend whereby it seems that companies are starting to take up the reins of some sort of areas that we'd expect government to step in. So filling in gaps of services that we would normally expect a government to fulfill, you know, because now they're these great citizens and so on, these corporate citizens. Can you tell us a little bit about the problem that exists here?
Yeah, so the trend is basically private corporations, usually quite large businesses, making intimations regarding taking over from where a shrinking government has left off in terms of welfare and public provisions, in terms of infrastructure, but even social issues around poverty relief, unemployment and so forth. And I think this is interesting, you know, because the problem with mainstream corporate social responsibility is that you can kind of easily dismiss it as window dressing or greenwashing, and that you know that the organization is just getting on with its revenue streams, and you know, you can kind of relatively take for granted that its CSR policy is kind of advertising. And there is a reason why CSR has moved into the publicity department of big corporations rather than in their accounting departments. But this is different because now you see, under using CSR, corporate social responsibility, as a vehicle, you see large organizations and business people, extremely wealthy business people, saying, look, governments are doing a lousy job in terms of inequality or poverty. They're doing a lousy job in terms of living standards for lower economic groups. And it is true to a certain extent, they are. So they're saying basically, look, we'll take over those social services and we will do them. Or we will take an interest in providing for services that we would have otherwise thought democratically elected governments would do. And Uber is a classic case here where they say, look, our social purpose is to allow the underserved lower economic groups to have an income. So we are stepping in and we are doing a government-like role.
Also an employment service?
Yeah, exactly. So this is actually an extension of corporate social responsibility into the realm of public services.
Mm-hmm.
And that might sound like an okay thing because, look, Bill Gates is rich. You know, why doesn't he fund a welfare state? You know, it sounds fine. We hear enough about governments not having enough money to spend on these things.
Yeah,
so
yeah, a small budget. Yeah, we can kind of run up a surplus in the government
Gina
side.
Gina Reinhart comes along and says, look, I'll pay for it.
Yeah, wonderful.
But there's a catch. There always is.
Okay.
And the catch is that really what they're saying is we will privatise it. Because if you think about it, the welfare state has still got a huge amount of resources associated with it. Mm-hmm. And corporations have been circling it for years.
Mm-hmm.
And they've made strong inroads into taking over contracting, for example, in the health service, education, another great example. Vocational education in Australia is extremely privatised. So that you've got this large structure, the public welfare system and governmental system more generally, which is extremely rich. It's the build-up of years and years of investment by taxpayers. And so it's not surprising that corporations are circling it, you know, thinking what part of it can they take over and benefit and turn into a profitable business. And so that's the worrying part, because you see creeping privatisation occurring, and so it might be argued, so what's the problem with privatisation? Well, nothing's wrong with privatisation per se, but there are some spheres of life that really ought not to be privatised. They should be at least accountable to democratically elected governments and the will of the people. And privatisation immediately takes that away, especially if it tends to be a monopolistic situation.
Yeah, I was just about to say, like, there are things that that the government provides, which I think through an economics lens, you know, and there's reasons why you'd actually want that to be in the hands of government, because they are opportunities for monopoly. You see, in terms of like postal services or the provision of telecommunications is a really interesting one. And some people are going to be served well by that, and some people, particularly, you know, if they don't live in an urban environment, are not going to be served very well by that.
Exactly. And also, you know, people's minds and views about things change, and there should be some sort of conduit or medium, which we call representative democracy, in which those views can then be integrated into, you know, how we go forward as a country. But when it's privatised in that regard, you know, unfortunately, one of the main characteristics of a corporation is that they have a huge democracy deficit. You know, no CEO is saying we'll take a vote. It's not how they work, and they never have worked that way. And so one is then worried about, especially in an oligopoly or monopoly-like situation, how that will kind of unfold. So turning, for example, welfare recipients into consumers, turning the poor into Uber drivers, what are the costs of that? And is that where a vibrant liberal democratic society ought to be going if we want to hold on to those ideals of some sort of representative government? And so this is actually a worrying trend, if you like, or development in corporate social responsibility, that it is no longer easily dismissed propaganda. It is actually real steps towards taking over certain institutional infrastructure that we would otherwise have thought governments, elected governments, would be taking care of.
So with, you know, CSR 2.0, how could we potentially combat or address, I guess what you're saying is kind of the encroachment of private industry into areas that would be otherwise kind of regulated or otherwise be the domain of the public sector?
Well, you can look at it from a whole host of reasons. I think, you know, the first thing we need to do is to identify the problem. And for me, at least, the problem, you know, corporate social responsibilities, you know, I don't have too many problems with it, but the main reason it is there right from the beginning is because there is a contradiction between what businesses do as a sector. Well, there can be a contradiction or a tension, and what broader society wants. And so you get corporate social responsibility emerging for a reason. Mm. And that reason is because, you know, of those tensions and contradictions. So I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, that contradiction is always at the heart of capitalism. The idea of having our cake and eating it is a dream. So there's always going to be that tension. And you've seen it, you know, with recessions, you've seen it with, you know, strikes and so forth, that it's going to come in many forms. But a CSR policy will not solve that problem. And this isn't an anti-business argument that I'm making. I'm just basically saying this is the realities of the system. What I would suggest, one way approach, and you can get too utopian with this, but I think in realistic terms, you know, we need to be thinking of the social contract. You know, so what should industry and organisations and employers be offering back to society in order for that licence to operate? And it's pretty clear that it swung very, very much, you know, in an extreme sense, into the favour of business. And we saw this with the Royal Banking Commission regarding how far things have gotten out of hand to the point where large banks basically thought, you know, it seems, you know, from the evidence that they could do what they liked.
The price paid by our community for this misconduct is immense and goes beyond just the financial. There have been broken businesses, and the emotional stress and personal pain has broken lives.
So rethinking the social contract in terms of going, okay, so if you do want a license to operate, what do we expect of organisations, particularly commercial ones?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think that's really, really important because, you know, there is a big legitimacy crisis in terms of this. And then you could think about what is the nature of that social contract. It could be things like taxation. And that's a thorny issue. And that's dependent on how you see economics working. And we don't need to open that can of worms. But the days of neoliberalism in which, you know, you don't tax corporations because if they get wealthy, they share it out to everyone else. Mm. You know, no one believes that. Not even corporate leaders believe that anymore.
No.
And so we really need to revisit that facet of the social contract, I think, in an important manner. But I think that kind of interface between what organisations do and large corporations and businesses in particular with a lot of power do in relation to society, that interface needs to be rethought as well.
In one sense, it would be easy to throw the baton over to, say, government on our behalf, society to, you know, we've got to rein in what businesses do. But if I just want to go back to those intended audiences of the CSR policies of organisations in the first place. So the graduate looking to get a job at a good employer, the consumer that wants to do good in terms of buying an ethical product, potentially even the investor as well. I mean, we can't just assume that they're dupes and that they kind of take this window dressing and they fall for it or so on. At some point also that the agency falls back on these individuals too. So what can individuals, the employees, the consumers, the people, the investors, the voters, what can they do to kind of redress this balance in defining the social contract with organisations?
So it's not about being fooled or tricked or, you know, having a false consciousness regarding the way in which the world works. I think there are reasons, economic mainly, why people get a job with an employer. You got to pay the bills, you know, and ethics tends to be secondary to paying the mortgage or you know, personal ethics becomes secondary to getting an education or what have you. And so what I think has happened is that everything, you know, whereas that economic instrumentality used to be one facet of society, one sphere, it's really come to dominate everything. And so in that society, it is not unsurprising that we act as instrumental, self-interested beings, because if we didn't, then I'd be living under a bridge downtown. And so therefore, you know, there is an element of individual agency there, but changing my individual practices, like putting out my recycling, isn't going to cut it. And maybe even choosing to work for an ethical employer rather than a non-ethical employer probably isn't going to cut it either. And so I think that what we really need to do is to kind of rein back that economic sphere. It's important and it's keyed into our survival and standard of living, et cetera, et cetera. But when that mentality really kind of overshadows things like civic, public spirit, a sense of community, when it overshadows everything else, then we run into the problems that we're seeing. And it's not necessarily that people have been duped and that CSR is kind of fooling people. That is the reality. And it might be a little bit of a panacea to know that my employer, if I'm working for a large oil company, is giving back to the local community in which it's digging up for an oil well. But it really kind of isn't getting to the heart of the issue. And I think that this is a societal issue and it's big, and that's why it's difficult to talk about without going into the kind of, you know, utopian realm. But there have been many societies around the world, and there are today, in which that economic sphere is one of many and isn't dominating everything to the point where, you know, and neoclassical economists become infamous for this, that they suggested that when I go home and I sit down at the dinner table and talk to my family, think of it as a market. It's a financial exchange. It's a money transaction, you know, because your kids, you know, they're only there with their food because you've paid for it, you know. So it goes a bit crazy, right?
Yeah.
So that mentality has spread throughout all of society.
Yeah.
And it has certain consequences. So I think that what we really need is to rethink the purpose of economics and the purpose of business, and think about how its ideological influence has really permeated everything. And business itself is not a bad thing. Corporations themselves aren't a bad thing. But we have to have some sort of balance, I think. And when that mentality dominates everything else, you know, my dinner with my family isn't as pleasurable as it was before, unfortunately, because I'm doing a cost-benefit analysis.
One thing I would probably take away from that is it's about recognising what is actually happening here. So we are now savvy to seeing some issues as just window dressing and can kind of and have adapted to that. And so if we can recognise the potential problems that exist with the encroachment of, say, CSR into realms of the public sector, we can then adapt to that again. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Perhaps drawing our attention to something that I probably would have taken a little bit for granted.
Right.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Thank you.
That brings us to the close of this episode of Think Business Futures. Think Business Futures is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This podcast is made by UTS Business School with the support of 2SER 107.3. If you'd like to hear more from us, head to the 2SER website, 2ser.com/thinkbusinessfutures, and you can also search for us on your favourite podcasting app. Our executive producer is Jason Lequier, and Ben Robinson provides additional production support. Thanks heaps to Peter Fleming for coming onto the show to talk to us about the changing nature of CSR. Until next time.